In 1996, a bombshell investigation shook America to its core. Gary Webb's Dark Alliance series in the San Jose Mercury News exposed how CIA-connected Nicaraguan drug traffickers flooded Los Angeles with cocaine, fueling the devastating crack epidemic that ravaged Black communities. The story became an internet phenomenon, receiving over a million hits in a single day, unprecedented for the early web era. Celebrities like Quentin Tarantino cited it as required reading, while hip-hop artists from Tupac to Mos Def referenced it in their lyrics. The explosive revelations sparked congressional hearings, protests, and a cultural reckoning that continues today. Despite a coordinated media counterattack that ultimately cost Webb his career and contributed to his tragic suicide in 2004, subsequent CIA and Justice Department investigations would vindicate many of his core findings. Dark Alliance remains one of journalism's most consequential exposés, revealing how American intelligence agencies sacrificed inner-city communities on the altar of covert foreign policy. When the Sandinista revolutionaries overthrew Nicaragua's Somoza dictatorship in July 1979, they ended a family dynasty that had ruled the country for over four decades with American support. Despite Anastasio Somoza's desperate pleas to U.S. Ambassador Pazullo, reminding him of the family's loyal anti-communist service helping overthrow Guatemala's government in 1954 and hosting the Bay of Pigs operation, the Carter administration abandoned him. The U.S. tried to preserve Nicaragua's National Guard as a counterweight to the leftist Sandinistas, but when Somoza fled to Florida on July 17, 1979, the Guard collapsed and the Sandinistas took control. This political upheaval created a wave of Nicaraguan exiles, including Danilo Blandón, who would become central to the cocaine pipeline. Blandón arrived at LX on July 5, 1979, the same day cocaine experts gathered in Lima to discuss the approaching epidemic. Just weeks earlier, he'd been wealthy and well-connected, the son of a landowner, married to a woman from a prominent political family, holding an MBA and government job. The Blandón family had prospered under Somoza's dictatorship, where loyalty was rewarded with riches. Blandón's father, Julio, owned the land beneath one of Managua's worst slums, Ciudad Sandino, where over 70,000 people lived in squalid conditions. By early 1981, former National Guard Colonel Enrique Bermudez was being courted by the CIA to lead the resistance against the Sandinistas. The agency's first project was uniting disorganized Contra groups under one umbrella, forcing Bermudez's Legion of September 15th to merge with the Miami-based UDNF-ARN, despite mutual hatred between the groups. The resulting organization, the Nicaraguan Democratic Forces, FDN, became the CIA's primary Contra army, with Bermudez and his ex-Guardia men taking leadership positions. In November 1981, Reagan approved National Security Decision Directive No. 17, allocating $19.95 million for covert operations against the Sandinistas. However, this money went to Argentine military advisors rather than directly to the Contras, who had to beg for funds. This funding gap created the opportunity that would connect the Contras to cocaine trafficking and ultimately to America's inner cities. "I was the first," Blandón later boasted about organizing resistance against the Sandinistas. "We formed a group in L.A. to go and fight against the Sandinistas that we called FDN." His group began as informal gatherings of exiles who met regularly to discuss developments in Nicaragua and raise funds through parties and rallies, though these initially brought in only a few thousands or something. Blandón claims he became a cocaine trafficker out of patriotism. His transformation began when Donald Barrios, a wealthy former insurance broker from Managua with ties to the Contras, arranged a meeting with notorious Nicaraguan gangster Norwin Meneses. At their meeting, Meneses proposed that Blandón start selling drugs in Los Angeles to raise money for the Contra Revolution. Meneses claimed he served as Bermudez's intelligence and security advisor in California, screening potential Contra recruits to protect against Sandinista infiltration. Nobody would join the Contra forces down there without my knowledge and approval, he boasted. Blandon confirmed this to the CIA, describing Meneses' role as primarily that of a personnel recruiter. Though Adolfo Calero, the CIA-connected head of the Contras' political directorate, denied the traffickers held official positions, he confirmed Meneses had visited Bermudas in Honduras. Former FDN director Edgar Chamorro acknowledged Meneses' involvement, explaining it occurred very early when the Contras did not have as many supporters and attributed it to the Brotherhood of Military Minds among former Somoza officers. Brandon insisted Bermudas never explicitly mentioned drug sales during his fundraising pitch, but the Contra commander told them the ends justify the means. The CIA knew Bermudas' group was already involved in cocaine smuggling. A September 1981 cable informed Langley that the Legion had made a decision to engage in drug smuggling to the United States and had completed a successful trial run with cocaine profits going to a Legion commander. After meeting with Bermudas, Meneses provided Blandon a two-day seminar on cocaine dealing, showing him how to assess quality, how to sell by ounce or kilo, and how to hide cocaine in vehicle compartments. Meneses gave Blandon 2 kilos of cocaine worth about $60,000 each, along with customer contacts in Los Angeles. Blandon began selling drugs for the Contras, taking 3 to 4 months to move the product. Eventually, he began selling ounces and grams, using the profits to send trucks, medical supplies, radios, and several thousand dollars to finance the FDN's Los Angeles wing. Ricky Donnell Ross, who would become the king of LA's crack market, first encountered rock cocaine around Christmas 1979. The 19-year-old was skeptical of the small white chunk that didn't match the glamorous powder cocaine he'd seen used on television by movie stars. His friend from the San Jose State football team introduced him to this new form of cocaine, claiming it was the next big thing. When Ross showed it to an old pimp who immediately wanted more after smoking it, Ross realized its potential but had neither the supply nor knowledge of how to make it. Growing up without his father, Ross found father figures in tennis mentors who encouraged his athletic talent. Tennis kept him out of the 74 Hoover Crips, his neighborhood gang. Despite being functionally illiterate, Ross excelled at tennis, making all-city first team his senior year at Dorsey High. His dreams of playing college tennis were crushed when a Long Beach State coach discovered he couldn't read or write. Through tennis, Ross met Mr. Fisher, an auto upholstery teacher who drove a Cadillac and lived in upscale Baldwin Hills. After their first failed attempt at dealing, Ross and his friend Ollie Newell stole a car, sold it for $250, and bought 3 grams of cocaine from Fisher. They cut it further and sold it for about $600, reinvesting their profits rather than spending them. While continuing his auto theft business, Ross's cocaine business flourished as wholesale prices began dropping. By dealing directly with Fisher's supplier Ivan, Ross got better prices and expanded from grams to ounces. After Ivan was injured, his brother-in-law Henry Corrales took over but lacked connections. Blandon saw his opportunity and became Henry's supplier, arranging a 50-50 profit split. Ross didn't know Blandon was now his cocaine source, but noticed prices dropping further with Henry. Around this time, Ross observed customers turning powder into rocks and recognized the potential. Though initially skeptical, South Central users soon demanded pre-made rocks for convenience. Ross hired someone to cook it before learning the simple process himself. Just cocaine powder, water, and baking soda heated until crackling. He began selling Ready Rock in $20 hits, first in foil, then glass vials. The product proved intensely addictive, with users never wanting anything else once they tried it. Crack cocaine hit South Central like a silent plague. LAPD reports first mentioned rock hard cocaine in May 1982, with regular appearances by September. Street cops encountered users with strange paraphernalia, tiny bottles of rum, glass pipes, and wire torches, but didn't initially understand what they were seeing. Crack proved ideal for street dealing, since it could be quickly destroyed if police approached. The drug democratized cocaine, both for users who could now afford small $5 to $25 doses and for dealers who needed minimal investment. By 1984, Blandon had been dealing increasing amounts of cocaine to Ricky Ross for 2 years without any police interference. While South Central cops were arresting dealers with unprecedented amounts of cocaine, the LAPD's Major Violators Unit dismissed concerns about black neighborhoods, believing the money's not there. Meanwhile, Meneses' San Francisco operation had been under constant investigation since 1981 by multiple agencies, yet remained untouchable despite only minor arrests of his nephews. Jerry Smith, former head of California's Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement San Francisco office, admitted they couldn't penetrate Meneses' tight-knit organization despite years of investigation. Meneses himself boasted of having a DEA agent on his payroll. Dennis Ainsworth, a conservative Republican who became involved with Contra support efforts in 1983, eventually concluded that Meneses was totally protected by the U.S. government. When Renato Pena and Jairo Meneses were arrested on cocaine trafficking charges in November 1984, Ainsworth began suspecting FDN involvement in drug trafficking. Despite overwhelming evidence against him, Pena received only a 2-year sentence. During DEA debriefings, Pena made astonishing claims that the CIA allowed Contras to traffic drugs for funding, stating Blandon claimed the Contras would not have been able to operate without drug proceeds. A DEA informant independently corroborated that Meneses was using drug money to buy weapons for the Contras, and that Pena was responsible for sending these proceeds to the Contras. When Ainsworth reported his findings to the FBI in 1987, warning that the FDN was more involved in selling arms and cocaine for personal gain than in military efforts, authorities showed no interest despite his receiving death threats. Despite substantial evidence against Norwin Meneses from his nephew Jairo's testimony and other sources, Meneses faced no charges or deportation, continuing to deal cocaine and support the Contras while maintaining an increasingly close relationship with the U.S. government. After his nephew's arrests in 1984, Meneses relocated his operations to his Costa Rican beachfront ranch. He owned several properties there and had important political connections, including protection from José Martí Figueres, son of a former Costa Rican president. Costa Rican authorities knew Meneses as one of the most important traffickers of drugs and noted he was one of the first economic supports of the FDN in Costa Rica. The DEA officially claimed Meneses volunteered as an informant in July 1986, citing his desire to clear up a minor problem with the IRS and help the present U.S. administration's fight against drugs, given Reagan's commitment to free Nicaragua. Danilo Blandon was instrumental in arming the dealers, beginning in 1984 when he gave Ross a free .22 pistol with a silencer. "Everybody that worked with me, everybody, bought a gun from him," Ross explained. Blandon sold everything from street sweepers and Thompson submachine guns to Uzis and AR-15 assault rifles. By 1987, the LA police listed weapons sales among Ross's enterprises. Blandon's weapons came through Ronald Lister and William Lee Downing's security business in Laguna Beach. Lister admitted selling Blandon one or two guns weekly, including machine pistols and possibly AK-47s. Blandon even arranged for Lister to give a sales presentation to Contra leaders, though they showed no interest, apparently already supplied by CIA or another U.S. government agency. Beyond weapons, Blandon sold dealers sophisticated electronics, walkie-talkies, pagers, police scanners, voice scramblers, and anti-eavesdropping equipment. During a 1987 raid, police were stunned by the dealer's superior technology, better equipment than we have. The FBI eventually took notice of Lister, questioning him about potential connections to Eastern Bloc countries and investigating his attempts to sell classified equipment to Soviet KGB agents. Lister's arms dealings were extensive and well documented. Between 1983 and 1986, the FBI opened 5 separate investigations into his illegal weapons trafficking. his company, Pyramid International, came under scrutiny for Neutrality Act violations involving weapon sales to El Salvador and Saudi Arabian money loans, though these investigations were mysteriously abandoned. According to arms manufacturer Timothy LaFrance, Pyramid's real CIA-directed mission was establishing a weapons manufacturing facility for the Contras in Honduras. LaFrance claimed they transported machine guns to Central America with unusually quick State Department approval and set up operations in a San Salvador transit center where they manufactured weapons later airlifted to Contra camps. These operations intersected with major drug traffickers like Barry Seal, who smuggled billions in drugs while simultaneously working as a DEA informant. Seal, described in records as a contract CIA operative, was murdered in 1986, and investigations into his Arkansas operations were reportedly dropped to avoid revealing national security information. By 1984-85, Ross was moving approximately 150 kilos weekly, enough for 3 million crack doses, with Blandon and the Torres brothers sharing about $5.7 million weekly from his purchases. Ross had so much cash that Blandon suggested getting counting machines, as they were counting day and night. Following Blandon's advice, Ross invested in real estate, including the Freeway Motor Inn that gave him his nickname. The crack explosion finally gained media attention in November 1984 when the Los Angeles Times published the first national story about it, describing hundreds of rock houses in South Central. The LAPD responded with raids, but crack continued spreading. Though initially confined to Los Angeles, DEA officials predicted it would eventually spread nationwide. By contrast, crack wouldn't appear in New York until fall 1985, nearly a year later. A 1985 USC study confirmed the dramatic increase in cocaine dealing in black neighborhoods through rock houses and noted the curious fact that crack was ethnically specific, found only in black areas, not Hispanic communities. Ross explained this simply: "There was no market until we created it. We started in our neighborhood, and we stayed in our neighborhood." The sociologists accurately predicted crack's national spread, describing the distribution system as custom-made for other black gang centers with high exportability. As crack exploded across LA, it dramatically altered street power dynamics by giving gangs economic power alongside their numbers and firepower. Ross became the dealer's dealer, supplying dozens of rock houses and catering to thousands of addicts. His operation expanded from regional to a coast-to-coast conglomerate, selling over 500,000 crack nuggets daily. As South Central's market saturated, his gang customers spread to other cities, establishing new crack markets nationwide. Ross fled Los Angeles with $300,000 cash, moving to Cincinnati with Mary Bronner and their children. In this quiet Midwestern city, he tried to leave the drug life behind, focusing on buying and renovating properties. Though financially secure from his LA real estate investments, Ross couldn't stay idle. He later reflected wistfully on this period. "I look at myself now and say, man, you had it made." Despite his retirement, Ross maintained contact with Danilo Blandon in Miami. When Blandon called from Detroit in fall 1987 offering cocaine at bargain prices, Ross couldn't resist. In Cincinnati, kilos sold for $50,000 compared to Blandon's $10,000 price. Ross accepted 15 kilos and quickly established crack operations across Cincinnati's poor neighborhoods using his proven formula, free cocaine, smoke parties, and volume discounts. He then imported Crips gang members from LA to staff his expanding enterprise. Ross's operation rapidly spread beyond Cincinnati to Toledo, Cleveland, Columbus, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Atlanta, and even Seattle. Police in Seattle considered his organization the single most important group distributing crack cocaine in the Seattle-Tacoma area. Ross claimed he sold 300 to 400 kilos of Blandon's cocaine in the Midwest over 10 months, netting around $2 million. Despite the Reagan administration's public war on drugs, CIA officers in Central America during the 1980s admitted narcotics trafficking wasn't a priority. One CIA officer bluntly stated that drugs were not something my agents were looking for in the 1980s. The unspoken policy regarding Contra drug dealers was that we were going to play with these guys. That was made clear by Casey and Dewey Claridge. This policy explained why Meneses could simultaneously serve as a DEA informant while dealing cocaine for the Contras. Even Meneses' DEA handler suspected he was trafficking while informing on other dealers. The FBI suspected Meneses had protection because he was working for the CIA. A 1988 FBI cable stated, Norwin Meneses was, and may still be, an informant for the Central Intelligence Agency. Shortly after approaching the DEA, Meneses was paired with a veteran CIA operative posing as a DEA informant. Their first assignment was to investigate Danilo Blandon's crack enterprise in South Central Los Angeles, suggesting they were monitoring rather than stopping drug trafficking. Much of the DEA and CIA intelligence about Meneses and Contra drug dealing centered around Guanacaste Province, a remote northern Costa Rican area filled with Contra camps and rural landing strips. According to a Costa Rican legislative commission, during 1984-85, this area served as headquarters for an international cocaine trafficking operation using Costa Rica as a refueling bridge. This operation, run with Manuel Noriega's help, used the same landing strips and Costa Rican authorities that aided the Contras. Former Costa Rican pilot Werner Lotz testified that planes would fly weapons to the Contras alongside drugs, leaving the guns behind before continuing to U.S. markets. The landing fees were paid with weapons, Lotz explained. Despite extensive U.S. surveillance capabilities and intelligence from Meneses himself, American agencies proved remarkably ineffective at catching drug traffickers. A Senate subcommittee found not a single case against a drug trafficker operating in those zones which was made on the basis of a tip or report by a U.S. intelligence agency. Costa Rican prosecutor Jorge Chavarria believed the DEA knew about the Contras and drugs, but were looking in the other direction. Even the DEA's Costa Rica office head admitted the Contra supply infrastructure was used for drug smuggling, though DEA leadership denied having credible evidence of such activities. When Webb's Dark Alliance series was published in 1996, it created an unprecedented media firestorm. The combination of talk radio and the internet saved Dark Alliance from disappearing without a trace. Mercury Center's Web Wizards created a revolutionary interactive page with animated maps, source documents, photos, audio clips, and more depth than the newspaper could provide. For investigative journalism, this was transformative. Readers could examine the evidence directly and make their own judgments. By sharing documents openly online, Webb bypassed traditional media gatekeepers. The web page received over 1 million hits in a single day. As Hotwired magazine noted, the story made digital and media history by fusing traditional press with the web, breaking modern media's parochial instincts. The Boston Globe reported the story was pulsing through black neighborhoods like a shockwave. This democratic access terrified corporate journalism, demonstrating that East Coast editors no longer controlled the national agenda. The public response forced action from California politicians, with senators and congressmen demanding investigations. CIA Director John Deutsch and Attorney General Janet Reno both launched inquiries. Eventually, even mainstream outlets like Newsweek, Time, and network television had to acknowledge the phenomenon. The establishment media's response was swift and coordinated. The Washington Post fired the first shot with Walter Pincus and Roberto Suro's piece, The CIA and Crack, Evidence is Lacking of Alleged Plot. They cleverly mischaracterized Webb's series as claiming the CIA deliberately targeted black communities and downplayed Blandon's testimony about selling hundreds of kilos for the Contras. The Post relied heavily on unnamed experts and officials, while burying key admissions that the CIA knew about some of these activities and did little or nothing to stop them. Webb's editor Jerry Seppos initially defended the series vigorously, noting the Post reporters could not find a single significant factual error despite reaching different conclusions. The Post refused to print his rebuttal letter. The LA Times and New York Times followed with similar attacks, admitting the basic facts while claiming they meant nothing. Despite uncovering more evidence, including eyewitness Carlos Cabezas, who admitted delivering millions in drug money to the Contras, DEA records showing Blandon sent money to Contras longer than previously reported, and a top CIA official admitting they had reports of drug trafficking, Webb's editors went silent. His follow-up stories, totaling 16,000 words, were never published. Instead, the Mercury News published a letter admitting mistakes in their reporting, effectively ending Webb's career at the paper. Ironically, subsequent investigations by the CIA Inspector General and Justice Department would vindicate many of Webb's core findings, acknowledging that the CIA had indeed worked with drug traffickers and failed to report their activities to law enforcement. But by then, the damage to Webb's reputation was complete. The story of how American intelligence agencies knowingly permitted massive drug trafficking to support covert operations remains one of the darkest chapters in modern American history, a chapter that Gary Webb courageously brought to light at tremendous personal cost.